a debate and dialogue between Dr. John Alexander and PRG Executive Director Stephen Bassett. We'll try to get some questions in from the audience at the end as well. For some background, for those of you who don't know, John Alexander entered the U.S. Army as a private in 1956. He rose through the ranks to Sergeant First Class, attended an officer candidate school, and was an infantry colonel when he retired in 1988. During his varied career, he held key positions in special operations, intelligence, and research and development. From 1966 to 1969, he commanded Special Forces A teams in Vietnam and Thailand. His last military assignment was as Director, Advanced System Concepts at the U.S. Army Laboratory Command. After retiring from the Army, Dr. Alexander joined Los Alamos National Laboratory, where he was instrumental in developing the concept of non-lethal defense. He conducted non-lethal warfare briefings at the highest levels of government, including the White House staff, National Security Council, members of Congress, Director of Central Intelligence, and senior defense officials. He also met with heads of industry and presented at academic institutions, including Columbia, Harvard, and MIT. In 2004, he addressed the German Bundestag, and in 2005, presented to international delegates to the Chemical Warfare Convention at The Hague. And academically, he holds an MA at Pepperdine University, PhD, Walden University, and did additional studies at UCLA, MIT, and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. This is but a partial representation of what is clearly a long and accomplished career in government service. But as most of you know, John Alexander has publicly engaged the UFO ET issue. He has attended and spoken at a number of conferences. He was part of an informal network, the Aviary, interacting with leading UFO researchers and activists decades ago. He was a board member of Robert Bigelow's National Institute for Discovery Sciences, NIDS, and he has, as you might say, along with his wife, Victoria, been a regular on the circuit. Not surprisingly, he is very controversial with an almost mythological web presence. Everyone who knows of John has a theory about John Alexander, but no one really thinks they know what's what when it comes to the Colonel. And just to think, he makes time to be with us here at the X Conference. On the other hand, Stephen Bassett took a very different path in life. He did not serve in the military, save for one semester of ROTC at Georgia Tech, when it was which was sufficient for him to persuade him to that perhaps that was not his line of work that he was cut out for. He was never recruited by the CIA. As a hardcore Sagittarian, he's almost always inclined to say what's on his mind. You may have noticed that, a trait which could be somewhat detrimental in practicing the deceptive arts. Actually, it's a trait that can cause all kinds of problems, but never mind that. And while he did get some hints early in life as to who he might be and what kind of work he might be best suited for, he says he didn't get that message until much later. Much, much later. And he says that message was activism. Well, populist advocacy has a long tradition in America. It's failed often and succeeded greatly. The American people just elected an activist community organizer as the president, and we'll see how that turns out. Time will tell. Whatever the issue, it always comes down to the people versus the government, a tug of war that's been going on since the first human stood up and said, "I'm in charge here." John Alexander is a quintessential insider. Steve Bassett is an outsider. They see the same issues from different directions, at times 180 degrees apart, but be apprised that Stephen, the son of a naval officer, does not view the government as the enemy, and has great respect for the highly trained and educated members of the military and intelligence community who've defended America for 2 1/3 centuries. Like all tug-of-wars, at some point, everyone has to put down the rope and go have some barbecue and coleslaw. This nation and all the issues it faces are the rightful provenance of all, military and civilian, insider and outsider, rich and poor, powerful and weak. And its future will rest on the sum of all its people and institutions. And with that in mind, John and Steve are going to engage each other here on the UFO ET issue. Everything is on the table. No subject is off limits. Two other points should be noted. First, this is not a debate between two removed and detached academics arguing the two sides of an issue without bias. Both of these men are part of the issue with strong views, so their involvement and past engagement of the UFO ET subject matter is also on the table for discussion. Secondly, John well knows the sympathies in this room are not exactly in his corner, but nevertheless suggested this debate to Steve. Steve, for his part, fully expects the audience to show appreciation for points well made by either speaker and keep an open mind so new ideas and new perspectives may find their way inside. So now, please welcome Dr. John Alexander and Stephen Bassett to the X-Conference 2009 stage.
Hello. For some reason, John insisted on going last. I don't know why, but whatever. So I get to go first. I think initially it's important that we frame our discussion, right? As clearly and as tightly as possible. Now, I'll try to do that, and you'll correct me, but boiled down to its essence, I believe that what's at issue here, aside from 1,000 sub-issues, is there a non-human intelligence, not born and bred on this planet, from obviously elsewhere, perhaps another planet, almost certainly another planet, or maybe another dimension, maybe from the future? All three of those situations are the same for me. But an extraordinary non-human intelligence, as we understand it now, engaging this planet or not. That is the issue, I believe, that's at hand. Is that a fair framing in your mind of the fundamental question?
Can I have the first slide?
Oh, no. He's going to go to the slides.
No, if we could, actually it's the second one.
Second one, okay. John bought a PowerPoint. I did not. I came into this debate PowerPointless.
I had to kind of guess where he was going, so this will jump around, but I have a few things. And if we get to it, what I thought would be useful is to, if you're going to have the discussion, start with the things we agree on.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And
Are you going to get, Jim's going to get that up for you? Okay.
Because there are obviously some fundamental ones that we don't. The first point will be that UFOs are real. I mean, there are real phenomena, and I use phenomena as opposed to phenomenon, like as it is a singular thing. I think it's much more complex than that. We also, I think, agree it's an important issue. It's something that deserves to be looked at. We also would agree that I think, can I have the next slide, the second one? We would agree that in general, and particularly as it refers to Roswell, the government has sort of had self-inflicted wounds. The reports that have been put out have been less than honest and certainly did not address the issue. The other was that we would agree to do this on a factual as opposed to an emotional basis, and we can agree to disagree.
However, let me go back to my initial statement. Yeah. Yes, points that we can agree on, perfectly appropriate, and we do on those things. But the issue, in other words, what is the issue under which we're, the reason why we're here? And I'll repeat the question. Is it fair to say that the reason why we're doing this at all, otherwise we wouldn't be, in my opinion, the question whether or not there is an extraterrestrial presence engaging us or not. Is that a fair statement?
Let me have slide five.
Slide five.
For those of you who heard Graham yesterday, my take is much closer to his than the ETH. The extraterrestrial hypothesis, will, in my view, does not answer the question. It does address a subset of the data, but certainly does not address all of the data. The pictures that are on this slide, for instance, one of them is a hard UFO that's taken over Argentina, pretty well known. So that's dealing with a craft. The lower corner, one of the things you see there is the balls of light. And these are part of the UFO phenomena that are not hard craft. But they seem to appear and get caught on sensor systems. I also threw in Cosmos, and quite frankly, Carl Sagan and I would not agree on very many points. Interestingly, one of the best books on the topic, UFOs, a Scientific Debate, he edited. And I was convinced after the SSE held a meeting at Cornell, he doesn't even read his own stuff. Because the book, when I say it's pretty good, it was literally a debate between proponents who argued facts, here's what we know about the things, and the opponents who argued emotion. Basically, it can't be, therefore it isn't. But one of the things I agree on, if you remember in Cosmos, the way the information transference occurred was just that, it was information. Rather than coming here, they designed, provided the information to develop the system that could be built here. And so, I mean, when you get into it, even having a crash or looking for unobtainium does not prove ET.
No. But again, and let me comment. What I think you've just said is an important point, that there's a lot of phenomena out there. And people are certainly paying attention, and a lot of information is coming in. And it's a perfectly valid statement to make that just, quote, the extraterrestrial hypothesis is not enough to account for all of this phenomena. So there very well could be some things which are being lumped into the ET UFO world that are in fact something else entirely, which is going to complicate things without question. And so one has to be careful, because if they glom onto some phenomena here that's really not related and try to bring it in, it's going to create confusion and it's going to make it more difficult to get to the essence. My point is that let's assume there are multiple phenomena. Let's assume that there's something that creates light balls that occasionally turn up, maybe even on the Skinwalker Ranch. I gotta say, I don't care about those. I don't care about witches and ghosts and shadow people or any of that stuff. If it's true, wonderful. So of the range of phenomena, the one that I care about is some of this evidence indicate an extraterrestrial or presence or not, which is to say that of the various things out there, the one that has, to me, preeminent importance is some of that phenomena confirming of an extraterrestrial presence. So again, my statement is, from the standpoint of why we would want to go through this, why we want to spend all the time to have these lectures and books, I believe the reason the people are here is because they are very much concerned and interested in whether or not there's an ET presence. And so again, I would like the debate to be not about what's going on in all realms, but rather is the ET debate a valid one? Is the, should the issue fundamentally be, in terms of what's most important, is there an ET presence or not?
I would argue what you're doing is exactly what the skeptics do, or the debunkers. What they do is they glom onto some facts that seem to fit their hypothesis. You may have read in the last few weeks, last couple of weeks, LA Times has an article about Area 51, pilots saying, we in fact flew that, and if you read the newspaper accounts, this explains UFOs. The reality is it explains a few UFO sightings. But what the skeptics always do is they glam onto a small piece, a few bits of the evidence, and they say, if this, therefore we have explained everything, when in fact they haven't. I argue, and I think what you heard with Graham yesterday, the issues of consciousness are far more important, and it is terribly complex. And the kinds of things you're saying, I just had a model that was published somewhere years and years ago based on phenomenology. And it said one of the things, you first of all, you have events, and then you accrue, and then pretty soon you start narrowing this field. You do a historical search, and when you start getting into history, you find out this stuff has been around much, much longer than anybody anticipated. Just really wasn't reported. The problem is, and when you get into, you know, seeing of craft and some of those things, that you see a strong correlation between the expectations of human consciousness and what is observed. Let me give you a specific example. Some of the things that were seen back in the 1800s, I mean, there were craft, but they weren't, you know, craft like they are now that zip around. There were airships, and they talk about people coming in and dropping anchors out of them and talking to them. Beyond their technological capability at the time, but nonetheless within the thought range. Jacques Vallée, who will come up a few times, and I want to mention, advocate one of his books, if you don't know, Forbidden Science 2 has just been released, which takes on the next decade for the 1970s of the research that, that he was doing. He had a classic case, early 1900s. It was in the state of Washington. Individual is driving around the corner, and there's this shiny object hovering right there. And the reporter said, I could see every rivet in there. Now, we know at that time, rivet technology and shiny craft would have been very advanced. We also know now it doesn't make any sense at all. You would never go that route. So the idea was the technology was not beyond what they could think about, but certainly it was not 1,000 years in advance, because in a few decades we had surpassed that.
What you see here is a classic example of a different perspective. I'm asking what amounts to a political question, and John is primarily answering in what amounts to an evidentiary phenomenological perspective. All right? And that's okay, except that, and believe me, I could easily dialogue him about rivets and perception and so forth and the way the phenomena, and we could do that. I'd be happy to do that later. But I really am going to get this us on the same page politically as well, because that's important. That's part of this. This is, after all, the Exopolitics Expo, the X Conference. So let me rephrase, John. Simple question. I'm asking two simple questions.
But exopolitics assumes the ET hypothesis.
Exopolitics does assume the ET hypothesis, okay? All right. Now, but just because it assumes it doesn't mean that you cannot discuss it from a political perspective, because one could practice exopolitics just like one would in political science might study a number of political fields. Political theories that they don't believe in, but they study them because they're part of it. So again, simple question, John. Simple question. Would you feel that the presence of non-human intelligence engaging us is a significant matter, an important issue?
Yes.
Okay. Would you also agree that if in fact no non-human intelligence is engaging us, but that millions of people think that it is happening, and many thousands are, studying it and engaging it and making it a very significant part of their life, when in fact there's nothing there, would be a pretty significant matter as well.
I'm not sure what the difference
is. In other words, there is in fact nothing happening here. No non-human intelligence is engaging this planet. But millions of people think it is. In fact, half of the American people do. So they are very profoundly mistaken, and of course many thousands of them are investing huge portions of their life trying to, quote, address this thing, which is in fact not happening. So this is a huge disconnect. Wouldn't that also be important as well?
Well, yes, but when you say non-human intelligence, actually animals have a degree of intelligence.
You know what I mean. A non-human intelligence from somewhere else, not this planet, is here at all, but millions think it is.
No, I would not necessarily agree, because that, again, assumes ETH. Now, I will argue, let me take a step forward here. I would argue when you do the math of the probability of life on other planets, it's almost overwhelming. Again, you get back to Sagan, he goes out there's billions and billions, and you go, and then turns around and says, not one shred of evidence. Well, I would argue there are lots of shreds of evidence.
Sure.
But, again, the problem gets into, where are you going
to
cut the pie?
All right, let me cut the pie for you. I'll cut the pie. I can cut pie. I can't eat it, though, because I'm on Atkins. But the point is, I can cut the pie. Look, 90% of the people in the United States, when polled, believe that there's life somewhere in the universe. Okay? And that's pretty okay, going through your life, having a good time. You think there's life out there in the universe? 20, 50 billion light years away? Yeah, I really think so. Okay, no big deal. That's not going to shake anybody up. I don't think we're going to spend the rest of our life devoted to that, unless you're a high-level physicist. But if you think that entities are coming into your bedroom at night and pulling them out the window of your bedroom without opening the window and taking you into a craft where they're putting probes in your body, that's a little more personal. That's a little more intense. Now, if that, in fact, is not happening, if there is no, quote, presence coming in and doing things like that, but people think they are, I think that's a big issue. Do you agree with that?
Well, but let's understand, this has been going on long before there were
UFOs. Whether it's been going on for one day or a thousand days.
No, this is a tiny piece of the phenomenon, and this is where I argue that the ETH is if you want to eliminate all of the other possibilities, you know, that's the wrong approach. Beings have been seen. It's long before UFOs were around. You go into human mythology, you know, for thousands of years. One of the things I liked about Graham's, I have worked in phenomenology, and last year, I've worked with shamans around the world, spent time last summer at a shamans conference in Iquitos, Peru, and I've interviewed a lot of them. We, in the Western world, talk about the spirit world and the real world as if these are something separate. When you deal with the shamans, they move seamlessly between these. Now, you're trying to frame this argument in the here and they, and that it's totally separate, when in fact the idea of beings, of people going interdimensionally, with or without bodies, these sorts of things have been around since there's been humans.
But my question is not about what is the explanation for this. Let me rephrase it again. Now, and the reason I'm pushing this, I don't want to sound like I'm being intransigent, but in fact, what's going on right now here cuts to the absolute essence of this. In other words, what is the political issue here? So I'm going to make it even simpler. Now, John, I know I'm going to get an easy answer from you on this. I think we fully agree, because I'm going to narrow this even closer. I'm not saying that this is the only explanation, and I'm not saying that there aren't multiple phenomena, but I'm doing something very simple. I think we agree that if beings that come from another planet in another star system have come to the planet Earth, that's a big deal. Okay, now.
To whom?
In general.
That's not a light question.
No, in general, to society, right? That from the standpoint of society's interest, from the standpoint of governance, I don't want to parse here, but do we not agree that if beings from another planetary system are in fact visiting our airspace now, that would be a pretty substantial issue? Yes or no?
To whom?
To
the American people. Because we talked to the people in this room see that as very serious.
All right, let me ask a simple question.
Public?
let me do this, John. How many people here think that beings from another planet coming to our planet, being in our space now, is a big deal? How many? That would be everybody. Okay. So now let's get to the second half of the question. And the second half of the question is very important. Is it not also significant that if millions and millions of people seriously believe that entities from another planetary system are here, when in fact that's not happening at all, something else is going on or they misunderstand, that's a pretty serious issue too that probably should be rectified. Is that a fair statement?
But what we know is that about 70% of the population believe that UFOs are real.
I know, and most, my point
and
is...
most of them believe that, you know, they come from another solar system.
Exactly.
Like that. But
yes,
it ain't important.
You mean it's
as
not?
A matter of fact,
you mean it's not important if it's totally wrong?
No,
if their belief is completely misplaced?
No, but what's important is I got to pay the rent right now. Got to have food on the table. Got to have, you know, the daily things. Overwhelms most people. Now,
all right.
You asked a political question, so let me address that because I brought that up before. Politically, this is a strong negative. A strong negative. If you come out and ask Dennis Kucinich, for instance, who, you know, has popped up, anybody who pops up in the political spectrum and talks about phenomenology of any kind is the victim of ad hominem attacks. You know, if you believe that, you must be crazy, therefore we can't trust you with our vote.
Right.
I mean, that's the correlation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're getting there. We're almost there, folks. My framing that I started with had two panes. You know, like the window with two panes, one on the top, one on the bottom? We've got one pane down. It's covered. We're going to get this second pane pinned. Let's see if I can do it this time. Let's go back to the 1930s. Well, it goes back long before then, but let's focus on the 1930s, 1930 to 1937. Essentially, in Europe, millions and millions and millions of Europeans, particularly Germans, believed that Jews and a number of other types of people were inferior. They were less than human. They were repugnant, and they should be shunned. A great deal of that, the great deal of the reason for them believing that was that their government told them that. In other words, the government presented a reality to them, that that was, in fact, the way things were, and they believed it. I would say that the fact that millions of Europeans believed something was true, what I just referred to, when it was not, given to what it led to, is a significant issue. And so my point, again, is if millions of people believe that non-human intelligence from another planet is engaging this planet, and in fact that's not true, meaning they've got that information from whatever sources, but it's totally wrong, and so whatever time they invest in that issue is a waste of time, that disconnect in reality is significant. That's a simple question. Is it a bad thing if millions of people have a complete misperception of reality at that level?
I'm not sure which side you're taking in this argument. Are you talking about the believers, or the ones who don't?
No, I'm saying that if millions of people believe something is true when it's not, right, and even invest great deal of their time in addressing this issue, which is not true, when they think it is, that kind of disconnect is very significant and is not healthy, and it's a big issue. That simple.
Yeah,
not getting it?
Am I really not getting it across?
Do you all get what I'm trying to say? Okay. And in other words, I'm getting the political question. A government can tell you something is there when it's not, and it can tell you something isn't there when it is. Let me rephrase the question, John. Not too long ago, the United States government, using the vast resources that it has in terms of media and information, informed the American people that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And in short order, more than a majority of the American people believed that to be true. So essentially, they believed something was true that wasn't. And because of that disconnect to reality, we went to war in Iraq. Now, I don't want to argue the pluses or minuses of that, but we know the costs. in lives and treasure. And one would argue, well, if in fact the actual reality and what Americans believe were concordant, that a better decision would have been made. Now, in the case of the ET, the government in that case said something was there when it wasn't. In the case of ET, the government is saying something isn't here when perhaps it is. In both cases, you have a disconnect. Now, John and I have agreed that if ETs are in fact here, it's a big deal. What I can't seem to get him to address is if in fact millions of people think they're here, but they're not, that's also a big deal. Maybe you think it's not.
Okay.
It is?
It would.
Then we're here. We're going to close that window and we're going to move on.
I don't see the relevance. I mean, go ahead and see how that ties to the...
That's okay. You don't have to see the relevance. I mean, we have different perspectives.
We're building this case.
Okay. Now.
You have to do the gotcha later.
No, there's no gotcha here. No gotcha. All right. Now, with that out of the way, so we have a significant matter here. Are ETs here? Are they not here? And now let's get to that. My best perception of your fundamental message, and you have given this message a number of times. In fact, it's in this slide presentation here, and you're pretty consistent on, you're on message, because I've seen you present about three times, and it's pretty much the same presentation every time. At the core of what you're saying is that you were operating through many facets of governance in terms of military service, in terms of service at the Pentagon. You had high levels of classification, very high levels of classification, access to a lot of people. And there are these individuals saying that the government has done this and the government knows about that and there's an ET presence and the government is involved in that and is even managing the issue in MJ-12 or whatever. In other words, there is a reality within government connected to the UFO thing, a significant reality. And I believe what you have said on several occasions is that if that were the case, given the levels of access you have and the people you know, you would know that. You would have been told that. And you haven't been, therefore you feel that simply is not the case.
It's not quite that simple.
Okay.
Because the answer is, the stuff doesn't just come to you. The difference between me and I think most everybody else is I'm the only one who went and talked to director or deputy director of all of the lettered agencies you know and some you don't.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the they. And what this is, when you get into this, you have classic conspiracy theory. Let me digress a minute and tell you one of the incidents in Jacques' book. Again, it's the 1970s. He is dealing with a number of the intelligence agencies. And he goes in, and in the book he says, we're going to have briefings. His belief was that he was going to learn the information when he talked to CIA, NSA, DIA, etc. Every time he got there, he said he found out that he knew more than they did. But the questions that were asked were not about the phenomena. The questions were all, what are the other agencies doing? And this is the one of the things you find. And I found this at very high levels. Some of the basic assumptions that you hear within this room about, this was my main message when I said there's good news, bad news, right. and other. You know, the good news is the government's telling the truth. The bad news is the government's telling the truth. The reality is they don't care.
Mm-hmm.
And that was generally, you know, what you found out. And the assumption even of those, remember, this is a very large organization. We know that 7% of the population, about adults, have seen a UFO. So within this organization, you find people have. I gave an example, and this is one that runs out of Edgar's here, but I talked to another person who held the position when he talks about Admiral Wilson. In that case, he said, A, we don't do that. B, let me tell you about the ones I saw. So you had a 3-star who had personal experience, who had no problem with reality, and yet say, there's nothing in the system because the system does not accommodate this. By the way, one of the things that happened, because we heard FOIA, one of the bad fallouts from FOIA, and this has been validated from multiple sources, when the Freedom of Information went into effect, they had no concept that 50% of the inquiries would be on UFOs. I mean, it was more about what's going on in your personal life, what records have been held on
that. They were overwhelmed.
Yeah. It got overwhelming. And when these came in, what they finally did is they got tired of going through the files and releasing them and looking. So finally what they did is they put in filter systems. So if anybody from the field sent in a report that said UFOs, the system wouldn't even accept it. Now, I argue that's wrong because that gives you scotomas.
It is wrong.
But the point is that the response to the FOIA request was such that they said, we can't put up with this. The administrative burden was too high. So it just now it just rejects it, so it doesn't even go into the system.
I'll return to that. That's because you brought up a very interesting point there, but I'm going to return to that. But let me go back to where we were. I want to focus on this. You worked at the Pentagon for, you were, I think, actually assigned at the Pentagon for a number of years. About how long?
Right.
About how many years, roughly? Do you recall?
I don't know. I was actually in the building in the early 80s.
In the 80s, early 80s, number of years. Okay. You've had multiple assignments around the world. And you held, what was the highest clearance that you held? Are you able to say?
We won't go into that.
Okay.
But
you held multiple
clearances.
Most anything
you can imagine.
Okay. And you have dealt both directly within your work and in your, within government, people you're working with, your colleagues, as well as people that you're interacting with as part of, outside of government, as part of your work. And then, of course, since you've left, you've gone to some very high-level events. So you've had enormous contact with substantial numbers of people of considerable rank and station. Is that a fair guess?
That's fair.
In all of that time, going back in your career, has anyone of significant rank and station ever told you that, John, this E.T. thing you're hearing about, this extraterrestrial issue, beings coming here, craft, it's true?
I'm not sure what you're describing. If you're saying, there's two different things. One is, there are sensor systems that pick up these things. Basically, every sensor system we have. The point is, not significant. Now, if the question is, this gets into like remote viewing, is there a program? That's where it falls apart.
No, not a program. No. I'm saying they say, John, look, the extraterrestrial issue about beings coming here, crash vehicles, bodies, it is true.
Where you're at is personal belief systems.
I'm just saying, has anyone ever said that to you? Have they ever told you that?
They said that I believe, yes. So I just gave you an example of a three-star who said, I've seen them.
He said, I've seen something, right? Meaning I've seen some UFOs.
He was sure at the time, he said, I'm sure that this was not a capability that we had.
But he's speaking to a specific event. I'm actually saying something stronger. I'm a rear admiral, okay, in U.S. Navy intelligence, and you and I are having dinner. It's about something else, right? Whatever. We've had a couple of glasses of wine. And over that wine, I look to you and say, John, you know the E.T. thing, the extraterrestrial with the bodies and the craft, that really happened. That's true.
Bottom line is no.
No, okay.
My experience is very much like Edgar said this morning, talking about the Apollo, and
yeah.
I think that's really key, something we should come to. Mm-hmm. My experience, we heard Nick Pope, he and I have talked about this online, offline, in the UK and here. Our experience is very, very similar.
Yes, very good. Now, let me follow that line up a little bit further. If during your career, some pretty high-level people of impeccable credentials that you respected, had in fact said to you, John, Roswell was real. That was a real craft. We got some bodies. Obviously, I can't go further. This is off the record. And this had happened a couple of times. Would you relate that to us?
Well, if
without naming their names.
No, the answer is A, didn't happen.
But
B,
if it did,
the set of circumstances, I think, would have been very different because I would not be in a position where I come forward and said, you know, here's what our experience is. In other words, you would just never hear about it. But I have talked to all of the theys. And as I said, as I talked to these senior officials, many of whom assume the reality, and some have seen sensory data, but they always assume they are taking care of it. It's always somebody else. And remember, I had a slide, I don't know, I may even have it in here. I won't I'll try to find it right now, but when we put this working group together, my basic assumption and the assumption of the group was the Raiders, what we call the Raiders of the Lost Ark scenario. That was, crash was real, we had it, we looked at it, figured, what the hell, can't figure this out, put it away and we'll look at it in 50 years. That was the assumption. And that's why I was surprised that, and that is the assumption, I think, even today in certain agencies, until we found out that we had run out of days.
Interesting. I'm not referring to a circumstance where someone says to you, John, I assume that there was a crash at Roswell or there have been ET bodies. I'm saying, I'm a rear admiral and I say, John, look, just off the record, the ET thing, this idea of craft, this idea of bodies visiting us, it's true. Can't give you the details.
Never happened.
Never happened.
Never
and
happened.
My follow-up question is this. If that did happen, if a couple of people pretty high up, off the record, and that, I know this happens, you know, I've got a security clearance, you've got a security clearance, I'm going to tell you something off the record, I'm not worried about that going anywhere. If that had happened, right, assuming there wasn't some specific non-disclosure or classified reason, you'd relate that to us, wouldn't you? And say, well, you know, I believe this, I believe that, but I have had a couple people in government tell me that it's real. Would you have told us?
I have had. I call it the 98%. There's a number of people, one of whom spoke this morning, whom I consider personal friends,
right,
who are, you know, have been in key positions, and we discuss it, and we agree to disagree. The difference is that almost all, and even let Edgar speak, I thought he spoke eloquently to the Apollo program and said absolutely nothing in the Apollo program. Now, to me, that's actually one of the key issues. It is inconceivable to me, and I cleared this with him before he came in. He talked about why Apollo was to go into space. No, it was much more than that. The Apollo program was a strategic move in order to establish United States technical dominance in the world. Going to the moon was a demonstration of that, but it was far beyond just going to the moon. They had contingency plans for everything. Everything conceivable had a, and I argue that had they had any inkling that they might bump into ET, there would have been a contingency plan that says, oh, by the way, if you're out there and you bump into him, invite him to the White House or what are you doing? You know, and he will tell you, never even had a briefing. Now, that piece is kind of in the inconceivable to me.
All right. This is good. Now I think we're somewhere we can get to the nut here. You've made it clear that in your career, which has been high level, with significant classification and access. People of high station have not, they may have had views and theories and they may have had some interest, but no one has said, no, this is in fact real. Perfectly okay. And given that,
I threw in a couple last year of the key, because we said, Edward Teller was a friend of mine. I'm assuming folks know him, father of the hydrogen bomb, etc. And our hypothesis was, if real, if Roswell's real, and five people are in the loop, Edward would have been one of them.
Okay? Perfectly reasonable thought.
Had him to the house for dinner specifically to talk about this. He's interested. We got the Fermi issue laid out for us and all of that. Also said SETI's looking in the wrong place, et cetera, et cetera. We let him describe what he thought would have happened, which he described, and the scenario was very similar to ours, and not there. By the way, he was most interested in Cash Landrum from a radiation standpoint.
Okay. Let's, stipulating that the United States government and all its military services and all its intelligence services and all of its operations, particularly covert and black budget, are vast and extend across the entire continent, given that it involves several million personnel, I think it's fair to say it is deep, complex, wide, with many, many loops. All right? Stipulating that, I'll get to the point. I was called into a dinner party was arranged for me in Bethesda a few years back by some scientists that work at the labs. There's a lot of them that live in Bethesda. They make good money. Some of them are husband and wife teams, so they're pulling down together $300,000 to $400,000. Not surprisingly, they're very interested in UFOs, many of these scientists, and when you visit their house, you go in the library and it's just filled with books on UFOs. Okay. So I went to a few parties there, and then they said, we're going to arrange a little dinner for you to meet somebody, and so they did. And I went, and we had Chinese food catered in. This gentleman was a command sergeant major.
I know you're talking about, we agree to disagree. I've talked to bosses way, way up the line from him. When I was at Harvard, in fact, in my working group, the deputy military commander was in my group, and I went and addressed it with him. He says, no.
This command sergeant major is an African-American. He's a tough guy, hated Clinton, voted for Bush. He had extensive background going all the way back to Vietnam. He'd worked with Trudeau and others. And we had a nice chat. And then we got down to the reason we were to get together, and it didn't last very long. And he confirmed, yes, the ET presence is certainly real. He confirmed that Roswell was a crashed ET vehicle. And at the very end of the conversation, he said, and I'll tell you something you probably don't know. I said, well, what is that? He said, where do you think the center of the interaction or the center of this issue is in the United States, the ET issue? And this is somewhat vague. I can't be more specific than that. I said, well, you know, some people might say Area 51 or whatever, some base. He said, no, the center of this activity is West Virginia. Okay. A friend of mine who's been working on the Hill many years and pushing this issue very hard attended a cocktail party a number of years ago where there were some high-level people, and this party was regarding a space function of some kind. She went to lots of these things. And so people are having some wine and some drinks, and she sidled up to an astronaut by the name of Duke. And she asked him about the ET issue, and he told her flat out it was true. And I contacted him and asked him if he'd come. He had no desire to come. I have colleagues who have had people in government fairly high rank confirm it to them. It's true. We know many of the witnesses that turned up at the Disclosure Project. Not some of these witnesses were clearly shaky, but a number of them are pretty high level. And they have their own contacts, and they have been informed that it's true. And then, of course, that brings us to Dr. Edgar Mitchell. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, I think, has the kind of career and the kind of relationships that he's able to talk to people you and I can't talk to, and he has made it quite clear that he has interacted with a number of individuals, including a visit to the Pentagon, where he was given information and told, clearly off the record, as you know, he will not even name the names, and I think that's appropriate, that the ET issue, meaning non-human intelligence with craft visiting the Earth, is true. When Paul Hellyer became interested in the subject on seeing some things and learning about Corso, the book was flawed and it's probably not the best entrance, but he's a smart man. He's capable of parsing. One of the first things he did was to call a friend in the United States, high-level Air Force general. Now, you may say, well, he said that, but how would he have access to an Air Force general? Well, he was the Minister of Defense for the nation of Canada at the same time that Robert McNamara was the Secretary of Defense of the United States. And he was also Deputy Prime Minister. He damn well has access to Air Force generals, and he called up the Air Force general, and he confirmed, yes, Roswell is true. What you've heard, the basics, is true, and a lot more. And so what we come down to is this, John. With all due respect to your access and your ability to, you know, to go and get information, isn't it possible that you just haven't talked to the right person yet? Or if you have, they didn't want to tell you, but they have told other people, a lot of people, and therefore it comes down to this. Edgar Mitchell has been told it's true, and you haven't. So,
but you understand, and he mentioned this morning, and I give him great credit for this. The individual who has reportedly told him, and they may have a special personal relationship, has publicly denied even the discussion.
In the 13 years...
Bring up 26 while we're at this.
Let's bring up 26.
Go ahead, because this is...
We should have a... Oh,
okay. Now, I didn't want to get in and fiddle with it. This is the one with the individual here last year when Hellyer was talking. I found that discussion frightening. The issue that was frightening about it was his lack of... Now, was he the Minister of Defense? Yeah, he was a placeholder for a few months in Canada. His knowledge... which he said of the entire thing is Corso's book and was it Peter Jennings' special.
Right.
That was his knowledge, entire knowledge. There's people in here who know a hell of a lot more about it than he did. He made some outstanding claims, one of which we heard reiterated even higher. $1 trillion is missing, you know, in the black budget. And you go back and you look and you say, do you know what $1 trillion means, particularly in... We're talking about the entire U.S. budget, not this year, but at that time, the entire U.S. budget is missing. Well, we know that's not true. I mean, we know where the DOD is and all of this. What is frightening to me about it is that you have a senior official from another country who was involved in making policy regarding the U.S., who has so little concept of how the U.S. works. Is there, you know, black budgets and that? Absolutely. If you think there's no oversight, and this is one of the problems, I think this stuff goes into some mythical air and, you know, people just do whatever they want. There is A, oversight, and it goes both in the executive and the legislative branch, and there is intense internal competition. I mean, within black budgets, believe me, they're finding, particularly for the last decade or so, as our budgets have been on steady decline. So the fighting over this budget and the real world issues just eat you up. I mean, that's why when you talked about, is there some black organization that did it? Sorry, but one of the things that's happened, particularly out of Iraq and Afghanistan, is we have used and abused the military. We've called up every reserve force that we have, many of them multiple times and that. There ain't nobody left to do all of these mythical things that you want to allude to.
Your points about Hellyer are valid. Paul's knowledge of the subject is limited. And when he got galvanized to get involved and did so, I think he made some statements which are not supportable, but the essence of what he was saying, I think, was purely valid, but I think he made some statements. I actually mentioned a couple of things to him where he got it wrong. So in a sense, I guess we could accuse him of being a bit overzealous, but he was under a lot of pressure to come out and address the issue, and when you come forward like that, people come at you, and they just assume you're an expert. And so it would have been better if Paul had been a little more thoughtful. He's also 82 years old, but he's still very sharp. But I'm going to get to my point. So let's agree. Paul went a little overboard. But that's not why I brought up Paul Hellyer. Whatever lack of information he has about the overall UFO issue that would lead to the odd misstatement, the man is extremely sharp and more than capable of knowing whether an Air Force general is confirming to him that there's an ET presence or not. And so if I call up an Air Force general, he says, yes, Paul, that's true and a lot more, that's pretty straightforward. And so either that happened or it didn't. Now,
but
let me get back.
The difference is, and I had him, but the picture on there was a later conference in which he and I went head-to-head. And I met him privately, and I said, who's your source? He said, you didn't name your source. And I said, yes, I did. He says, well, you know, how did you get to be a colonel if you question a minister?
Didn't he tell you that he had agreed not to give that name out, that the fellow told him that and didn't want the name given out?
Like I say, when they're ready to come up, we'll go nose to nose, but like I say, come and lay the cards on the table. Because I told him who I have contacted, and yes, like I said, it was across the board. All services in the group that I had put together had representatives of all of the services, and we had been at the 3- and 4-star level and in the appropriate agencies within those services.
All right. Now, we're getting to an area that's a bit sensitive for me. We agreed that we would not get emotional. I never get emotional.
Not since last night.
But this gets us into an area that is deeply troubling for me. And I'm thinking, because I want to do this right, all right. I'm going to discuss a dichotomy for a moment. Whether the theory about origins are correct or not, it is in fact true that years ago, going back many, many years, outrageous stories would appear in tabloids, particularly the National Enquirer, and certainly the Weekly World News, all kinds of wild stuff, just insane kind of stuff, right? Then any reasonable people would dismiss, perfectly understandable. This is the low end, right, the low end. So if somebody reads in the Weekly World News that Clinton had lunch with an extraterrestrial, most of us would say that's nonsense. Of course you would. It's ridiculous. Okay, the low end. Now, as it happens, the founder, the person that created the Enquirer, was a former CIA agent. And that person then went on to create the Weekly World News. So this is an intimation about, how would you say, the creation, and I believe is true, of ridiculousness about the issue with a government origin. The government has exercised this prerogative to create and put out that kind of information. Certainly there's a hint of that happening, but whether the government was involved or not, it did happen. Now let's go from down here. Let's go from the Weekly World News, and let's go all the way up to the moon. Now, when you have a man who gets a PhD in astrophysics aeronautics from MIT and is so capable as a test pilot that he is selected amongst many to be the creme de la creme and be an astronaut, and is so capable as an astronaut that is selected to be one to go on a moon mission, and is so capable that they're selected to be the one to leave the craft and walk on the moon. If you have served as a captain in the service of your country, I'll get to the point. No, I'm going to get to that. Now let me finish this, John. I realize I'm belaboring.
And ask him what he said firsthand, because he said stated.
No. This isn't about that. I'm going to something else. I realize what you're saying. No, but I'm going to something else, and I'm going to hit it pretty hard. And you look at the career. You look at the career of Edgar Mitchell. All right. If Edgar Mitchell says that an individual told him something, and then that individual later says, "No, I didn't," I'm going to tell you flat out, the second individual is lying through his teeth, and Edgar Mitchell is telling the truth. I'll put my money on that, and I will collect that bet. And the point I'm trying to make is this issue has put lots of people, including yourself, John, constantly in a position where we have to call the highest level people that have served this country liars in order to keep this truth embargo going, and that burns my butt.
Yeah. Let me address that, because it's almost as if the person you talked to, he is talking about a person who was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, one of the three major or four major intelligence, part of the 12 in the community. I find it impossible to believe that if this were true, the individual, to have him come back and say, "I cannot get briefed," is totally illogical. Let me tell you why. The rationale is, and I've heard this, it's an interesting argument from even the proponents who say crash, yes, take it as a singular event that could never happen again. Okay? Now, here's a problem. When you read the literature and you hear about crashes and this incident and that incident, you hear about these quick response teams and whatnot. One of the things we look for is, where's the network? If the information comes in, how does it get to, you know, the agency that does it? As I said, the director that I talked to at a later time of the same agency said, we have no collection requirement, which was told to me, you know, by the same, by every other intelligence agency. If a crash occurs, if a major incident occurs, in order to get it into the system, you've got to have somebody who's looking for it. These are the people who control all of the intelligence that comes in from what we call our national assets. And they say, we can't get briefed. It defies logic. The emperor has no clothes. Well,
John, look, it's really very simple. Your deductive deduction there is perfectly reasonable, and it may be quite valid. But what is the point? Are you therefore saying that Edgar Mitchell was not told that? Or the person was lying to Edgar?
Neither of us were there. So okay. He and the admiral will have to say what was told. Don't know. But let me give you another incident that I think you're familiar with. This had to do with Bobby Inman. Yeah, an individual calls Bobby Inman and talks about a UFO, blah, 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 blah. And then they finally contact Bob, and Bobby says, oh, well, we had a collection, we had this and we had that. A lot of the times the question, you know, what question was asked or what question was perceived by the person answering the question. Mm-hmm. In that case, he said, I thought you were talking about Glomar Explorer. And yes, we did have a huge secret program. Some of you have seen now specials on it. It had to do with a Russian submarine that went down. We had a huge program that went out and actually captured the Russian missiles and brought them up. We had a burial at sea of the Russian crew and that. Bobby thought he was talking about that,
This
gets translated
sure.
to... You know,
happens all the time. You got people
are, unless you're there.
You don't know.
Understanding exactly what question was being answered, what the thoughts were.
All right,
but that's why mine have been unambiguous.
All right, and I think we can both agree that you weren't there when Hellyer spoke with the Air Force General. Are you saying when you ask Hellyer, will you reveal the source, and he didn't? You seem to be somewhat nonplussed that he wouldn't tell you the source. Are you implying that Hellyer was lying about that conversation with the Air Force General?
No.
Okay.
Well, I don't know what, I have no idea.
You have no idea.
What I can say is the information that he described...
didn't make sense to you.
It does, well, not only doesn't make sense, like I said, it went beyond not making sense.
Okay.
Just not even logical.
All right. Now, there have been a number of incidents, there have been a number of things that have happened where this has come up, and I don't want to get too much into this, because you say we're sort of arguing minutia at some point. By the way, what is our time situation, gentlemen? How far are we into this? Oh, okay. And I'm really bringing these up not to, quote, defend anyone, but rather to sort of demonstrate the kind of churning that's going on and describe what we're dealing with. This is a famous incident that occurred in which a meeting was set up, and a dinner was held so that Stephen Greer and CIA Director Woolsey would be in the same place at the same time. The meeting was set up by John Peterson, all right? I've seen the email, copies of the email, that were exchanged in the setting up of this meeting. And at that, quote, I say dinner, where a meeting took place. And at that dinner, there was a long discussion that went on between Greer and Woolsey. That's understood. Nobody debates that. And I believe others were, the wives were also there listening. Greer's understanding was that meeting was set up so this could take place. He referred to it as a briefing, which is a bit of a stretch. It's a briefing if you think it is, and it isn't if you don't. The point is that it did take place. He talked about that several times, but it never really went anywhere. But eventually, after a number of years, even though it was out, I think he mentioned it on Bell, it was out in a sort of off-to-the-side kind of thing, but eventually he wrote a book, Contact, in which he put this meeting and described it specifically in the book, meaning in writing out there. Now that creates a different situation. At that point, Woolsey responded, and he denied that this was special, that it was set up for that. He denied it was a briefing. He dismissed it as being as irrelevant, and John Peterson backed him and said, yes.
Well, actually, but I've seen
the emails that were exchanged, and that they are, how would you say, not concordant with John Peterson's response. Now, I can perfectly understand why Woolsey, who was still a significant figure, involved in multiple projects and frequently brought on television to comment on a number of things, would not want to be associated with the UFO issue. It's very possible that some understanding was made that night that it wouldn't be discussed publicly. This happens all the time, you know. I can talk to you, but it's off the record. And the Greer violated eventually that understanding. But let me be clear here. I do not believe Woolsey, and I do not believe Peterson. I believe Greer.
I believe John and Woolsey.
You believe John and Woolsey? Okay. So you see, so the effect of, quote, the embargo of information, the effect of playing games, the effect of disinformation, the effect of ghettoizing the issue where you can't be associated with it, puts people where they have to deny or not deny and take sides, and it splits things up. And we're not talking about just regular people. We're talking about high-level people, right? And so it gets kind of ugly in my sense. Now I want to change the subject. I want to go in a different direction, John.